Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
absolutely,
if we're uncomfortable
absolutely
talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
And good morning. Welcome to What's Next. Today, we talk to a recurring guest here on our program, Professor Henry Louis Taylor Jr., the director of the UB Center for Urban Studies. Dr. Taylor, thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here again.
It's exciting for me because the last time you were in, we were talking about the effort that was going into developing and finding and identifying a neighborhood in the city of Buffalo that was going to be the selected neighborhood, so to speak, of the East Side Neighborhood Transformation Project. That neighborhood has been selected. Let's talk about that.
Yes, it is. After an extensive study of some five neighborhoods and communities that became what we call our finalists, after we looked at all of the neighborhoods on the Buffalo's East Side, because early on we made the decision that, wow, that East Side is a huge geography, and it contains many different neighborhoods.
Certainly.
If we look at the census tract as a neighborhood, and there are complexities and differences across the space. So you couldn't really develop a model on how to transform neighborhoods and communities with the geography that large. So our first step in finding a location was to identify what we felt were the five hardest hit neighborhoods on Buffalo's East Side. And then we spent another 6 or 7 months in a detailed analysis of those areas. We conducted some 565 house-to-house surveys. We looked extensively at the census tract data. We made field visits to those locations and areas. We did an analysis of the compositions and the challenges and threats. And on the basis of that, we identified what we call the Upper Broadway Fillmore neighborhood on Buffalo's East Side, that is comprised primarily of census tract 166 and little portions of the surrounding areas. And it is there that we will be launching our neighborhood transformation project pilot study.
And just to spell it out in the imaginary map here on radio, it's Broadway to the south, Fillmore to the east, Best to the north, Genesee to the west is, in essence, the neighborhood we're talking about.
In essence, probably we'll go all the way up to Best, mm-hmm, and include Martin Luther King Park and the neighborhood. But those are the base level boundaries.
All right, let's go into that neighborhood then. All right, let's try to focus on that and talk about, you know, both, you know, the what you thought were important strengths or things to build on, and also obviously some of the challenges that are going to be ahead here as well.
And when we looked at the neighborhood, and there were several reasons that we selected that neighborhood and community. First, we were intrigued by this rare combination of a significant number of occupied housing units, over 1,000 occupied housing units, along with a large number of vacant land lots. Vacant lots not only on the residential streets, but also along the commercial corridors.
Right.
And what this did was to create a possibility of reimagining a neighborhood and a community in ways that we simply could not do in other locations and areas. Another prime reason is that based upon our surveys, that the residents who lived in that community were ready to fight to build and develop a neighborhood, to participate in the process of transforming their neighborhood and community. And to us, that was huge, because the people who lived there, one, had to understand that there were challenges and problems that were there. But second, they had to want to bring about change and be ready to fight to make that happen. And so that was an element. A third element centered around the fact that they had two very powerful neighborhood-based organizations. King Urban Life Center, which is kind of an anchor of that community, and the old St. Mary of Sorrows church that it occupies is the most dominant symbol within that area.
Certainly.
Combine that with the Broadway Fillmore Neighborhood Housing Services, you have two twin towers that we could collaborate to help drive the neighborhood process. Another element was we felt that this site was also in a gentrification threat zone.
Okay.
The Central Terminal was a stone's throw away and Broadway Market. And we knew that the activities there would stimulate the approach toward gentrification. And we already saw that beginning to happen with the Adams Street project. We noted that the community was close to downtown, 4 to 5 minutes from the Buffalo Niagara Medical Campus. Right across the street from Central Terminal and a stone's throw from Martin Luther King Jr. Park. So with those types of assets combined with proximity to the interstate, that's ideal place to gentrify. And so it gave us an opportunity to intervene and save a neighborhood from transformation into gentrified space. And those were the primary reasons that we selected it. We were also intrigued by the mixture of that population.
Okay.
It's primarily African-American, about 80% black. But there's also a significant concentration of Asians, mostly Bangladeshis, along with whites. And like most East Side neighborhood, it has a mixed income population. And by that I mean to say we have about 15 to 20% of the population that are making $75,000 or more, along with a significant number of folks that are making under $50,000, especially a large concentration of people under $20,000. And so you have that situation where the median household income in that neighborhood is only about $25,000 a year, and it has a super high home ownership rate. Some 69% of the people own their homes, but most of those homes were built before 1940, and the median household income for the homeowners is only about $28,000, $29,000 a year. So there are significant issues that are found there. And we felt when we put all of those things together, it made it an ideal site to test our model and to perfect that model of neighborhood transformation and development.
And so when you lay out those numbers, the income numbers for the households, it's quite startling to consider that. And as you said, it's a nice amount of people owning their own homes. Yet at the same time, and this is something we talked about when we were talking about the winter storm, the conditions of many houses in Buffalo, but specifically in the East Side, are so below general standards today. So that's something that's going to have to be a huge part of this, then, improving the current homes.
Yeah, and that occurs on two levels. One is that you've got to fix the renter-occupied housing units, because there's a serious problem of rent gouging in that neighborhood.
Rent gouging.
And I say we talk a lot about this affordability
yep.
issue, but the affordability issue is hiding large-scale inequities and exploitation that is occurring on Buffalo's east side. And by rent gouging, we mean the charging of excessive rents for substandard, poorly maintained housing units. And these renters are able to make substantial profits by minimizing the amount of maintenance costs and maximizing the levels of rent. So in the one of the poorest, if not the poorest, neighborhood in Buffalo, the rents there are almost at the medium rental levels for the city as a whole. It's insane. And we think that's, we call that rent gouging. And it's a process of monopoly rents because people are able to charge high rents because they know that people have limited options and choices. So one of our most important goals is we got to fix that rental housing while at the same time reducing the rents. Also, you have significant problems of repair that needs to be done with the owner-occupied housing units.
Okay.
So in a lot of these equations, we forget about the owner-occupied housing units. So 69% of the people own their homes, but the median value is only about $46,000. And so it exposes the myth, and I want to say that again, it exposes the myth that politicians and many of these realtors say that home ownership is an instrument of wealth production for Black people. And for the vast majority of Black people, especially in the city of Buffalo, that's just not true.
Right.
And then when we look over time and in the present, for many African Americans, owning a home is not about wealth production, but it's about intergenerational asset production. And by that, I mean to say people buy a house with the intention that they'll leave that to their kids and they will live there. And then their kids' kids will live there. And their kids' kids will live there. And the home gets passed from one generation to another. And when that house is sold, that moment is seen as a moment of tragedy because the cycle is broken and the family has lost an asset. Even in my own life, my great-great-grandfather in Nashville built a beautiful home that he lived in. Even had all kind of exotic woods and stuff because he was wealthy for that time. When he died, my mom moved into the house. I was born in the house. Then when we all left and my mom passed away and my dad moved away, my sister lived in the house. And when she sold it, we cried.
Mm.
It was tragic. But today, on my father's side, the house that his father built back in the 1890s, we still got relatives living in it. It's on the historical record. Seriously.
Okay.
In Memphis, Tennessee, relatives are still living in the same house. And I still own 5 acres of land right around the corner. That's been in the family since 1868. Someone just called me last week wanting to pay me over $100,000 for the land. I said, thank you, but no thank you. He said, there's nothing on it right now. I said, consider it a nature preserve. So I'm simply saying
sure.
That we want
right.
to preserve these units, raise their qualities, and develop a strategy for working with the existing homeowners so that they can improve the quality of the housing units that they live in. as an asset to themselves and their families. And then we also want to be able to greatly expand ownership in that community. But a communal forms of ownership so that the land and the property in the community is owned by the people who live in the community, and the wealth that is produced there can be used to be reinvested in those neighborhoods and communities, making them healthy, thriving, and joyful communities. And you'll hear me talk about joy a lot,
yep,
because life is about joy. It's about joy. And we should be intentionally creating communities where people can experience joy because they're healthy, because they have a job that can that allows them to live a good life, so that they're eating wholesome foods, they're exercising, and they're joyful. They're joyful. And that's what this movement is about.
Dr. Henry Louis Taylor Jr. with us from the UB Center for Urban Studies, talking about the East Side Neighborhood Transformation Project. Just intriguing descriptions there with so much to follow up on. You mentioned the concept of communal ownership of property in this neighborhood.
Yes.
So what... Lay that out. How that are we talking about currently abandoned properties being purchased in some sort of neighbor, making it a, for to follow your term, a neighborhood asset?
Yeah, when we look at neighborhoods on the East Side and you see the decay and the dilapidation that's omnipresent, the first question I ask, well, who owns these decaying buildings? Who owns the house with the broken window? And what we find over and over and over again is that a significant amount of this land is owned by people who don't live there.
Okay.
Many people who don't even live on the East Side, and a significant number of people who don't even live in Buffalo, and a surprising large number of people who don't even live in Erie County. And that the people who live in those neighborhoods and communities have literally no say over how they are developed and grow over time. Outsiders have that. Even the city owns large numbers of vacant land in these areas. And I pose the question, is the city a corporate structure that's independent of the public? Or do those lands belong to the people and the city as a caretaker? Right now, the city treats those lots as if that that's their own private and personal property, that the city, independent of the people who live there anywhere, can do whatever they want to. Are we the servants of the government? Or is the government our servant? Do we live for the government, or does the government live for us? We think the government lives for us and that the government is our servant. And if that is the case, then the properties that exist in a neighborhood and a community, the people who live in that neighborhood and a community should own and control what happens in that space. As long as they're living by the rules of inclusivity, belonging, and not excluding individuals and people. So for us, that means that the utilization of community land trusts to develop those spaces on behalf of the people who live there, and to use the profits that are generated from those spaces as community wealth to be reinvested in that. And I also believe that the government should finance these community land trusts. And I think that right now, in a way, we've turned the world upside down. We have a publicly financed land bank. And what is the purpose of the land bank? The purpose of the land bank is to move publicly owned property into private hands, and that the wealth goes into some dark, unknown hole to be utilized by people, and we have no idea even what they do with our money. And I say our money, if the government belongs to the people, then the taxes represents a source that the people have every right to make decisions about how it is invested inside of the community. So we want to flip all of this and use community land trust as a way to do that. We also want to encourage cooperative ownership of housing. So if Billy Joe or Mary Sue or Annie and Josephine can't afford a house by themselves, let them pool their money and buy a place together. And that's what we mean by collective ownership and cooperative ownership. And right now, that's a way of life among Black people down on the ground. And I submit that the most powerful institution in the Black community today is a co-op. We call it the church.
You got me there.
We call it the church.
Right.
The minister don't own the church, although some ministers do think they own the church. They don't own the church.
Right.
The people own the church. The minister works for them. And so over and over and over, when we see people pool their monies collectively and embrace the collective spirit, beautiful things happen. And if you really go down deep in these neighborhoods where people have limited resources, you see reciprocity and cooperation and collaboration as a way of life. We talked to one of the neighborhood residents in one of the most profound conversations I've had this year or last year or any other year. Mrs. Triggs, hopeful she won't
Sycamore
mind.
Street.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm sitting down talking to her, and, you know, you're around Miss Trigg, you're going to eat.
Yeah, I've seen that.
And we're talking about collaborating on a project, and she said, look, there's this woman who is having some trouble, and she lives in a house, and it has some damages to it. She owns the house but can't afford to get that fixed. So we're going to put together a team, and we're going to fix that house. And she said, y'all want to work with us? I was struck. The residents organizing a team of people with appropriate skill levels to go to a neighbor in need and to fix their house so that it is livable and that they can remain there. That's communal living. And the thing that crossed my mind, I said, wow, we have to figure out how to bring that to scale. We have to figure out how to institutionalize things like that down on the ground. And so that's what I'm talking about, how when we learn from the people. Because one of the most important things that we've learned from this project is that to be successful, expert knowledge must be integrated and blended with street knowledge. And so for all of us in the academic, intellectual world, we have to find our way down on the ground and spend time with the street professors. So I'll spend time with Professor Triggs, Professor Giles, Professor Corey, and a lot of the other street level professors who teach us about what's happening down there. And then we get in the lab and blend all of this street knowledge with expert knowledge and produce new insights, new ways of understanding, and then implement that. And that's the superpower in the project that we're developing on Buffalo's East Side, the blending of expert knowledge with street knowledge in order to create a new type of hybrid knowledge that's more powerful because it's a synergy between the street and the academy that is producing something unique and special.
With us, Professor Henry Louis Taylor, Jr., the director of the UB Center for Urban Studies. We're talking about their East Side Neighborhood Transformation Project. If you missed the news, they have selected what's known as Census Tract 166, roughly, section of the city, Broadway on the south, Fillmore on the east, Best on the north, Genesee on the west. And you've intrigued me on a lot of different levels here, the communal ownership of property. In essence, you're calling on the city to release and perhaps help fund the concept of building a land trust in this neighborhood. What has to take place for that? Is this a legislative issue? Is this a policy, an executive policy issue?
I would think it's a policy issue. The process of setting up a community land trust is pretty straightforward. I mean, it's pretty much a 501c3. You develop a board of directors, and all of the members of the community are part of the land trust, which means they have an opportunity to vote.
Would the people need to be residents of the neighborhood to be on that board?
Not always.
Okay. All right.
When you set it up, you can construct the bylaws to allow whomever you wish to be a part of it. But I think the great challenge, I mean, for example, we have a community land trust the Fruit Belt, mm-hmm. Grassroots Garden has a community land trust, and there may be others. But the problem with, or the great challenge that many of the land trusts face is a source of funding.
Right.
Because most of them are funded on the basis of private donations and the like. Across the nation, there are instances where they are government-funded community land trust, and the record with them is mixed. But it's a choice and a decision that city governments can make. And the precedent for that is the fact that they've established land banks. And a land bank is the flip side of a community land trust.
Right.
Instead of acquiring and developing properties for the residents that live in a community, although they can do that, it's mostly about the movement of publicly owned land to private ownership. And so we would like to see that flipped and you develop a publicly financed community land trust, which would give it a much more power, a lot more power to acquire and develop property. And it would mean a shift of policy where residents are given the authority and the power to develop their own neighborhoods and their own communities. So we think that's a part of it. And from our standpoint of view, the vacant land that exists within the context of a neighborhood represents a community commons. And as a community commons, it belongs to the people who live in the neighborhood and the community, and that the city and as the owners of those properties are really the keepers of the sacred space of the community, which means that when the time comes, at no cost, those properties should be released to the community. Currently, that's not the way the city thinks. Currently, the city sees these lands as commodities that they want to sell for the highest possible price in order to generate a profit. And that's a relatively recent vintage. Once upon a time, if you came to the city with a plan and a strategy, you could get that property for a dollar.
Mm.
And I know we acquired at the UB Center for Urban Studies an entire city block in the Fruit Belt, fronting Futures Academy, where we have built Freedom's Rebel Garden, a beautiful green space. And that land was gifted to us by the city. I mean, they still own it, but we have maintained it for over 20 years.
When we talked prior to the selection of the neighborhood for the transformation project, you did suggest that there are interests in you had interest in funding, people interested in helping fund this project. You know, it's one thing to talk about it. It's another thing, of course, to see it become a reality. Is that, are you still seeing that strong sense?
Yeah, we're close to the end of that road. And so the project is now in what we call a pre-funded phase. But we hope to have funding in place by early summer.
Okay.
We've had a number of talks with a potential funder. They will be coming to Buffalo in April for a field trip. Then we'll have more interaction during that field trip. They've already read our proposal, and they like what they've seen. They have questions that they want to ask us. And all of this is before we actually submit the proposal to them. So we feel very, very good about that. We're waiting before we pursue other funding sources, because once that main funding is in place, then we'll know specifically where our other needs are. But we're not waiting for that. The project has always been built and centered around building partnerships and collaborations and leveraging the resources of other individuals in order to drive the development of the neighborhood and the community. So we've never looked at one source being the source that is funding everything. That just puts together a staff and a team. But this is about leveraging. So right now we've built a partnership with the East Development, East Side Development, or the East Development Corporation, headed by Essence Sweat, and along with a partnership with Habitat for Humanities. And we're moving forward utilizing Sean Ryan's brilliant block-by-block neighborhood development strategy to begin to move forward toward housing development on Buffalo's East Side within the context of Census Tract 166.
Are you already seeing that money getting into the Census one Tract 166?
A portion of it will be, yeah. Okay. We're still in the stage of identifying the properties that will move from vacant to rentals, and getting that application in. The infill housing strategy is just getting started. And we're working to put together the different development teams that are there. So we're in the preliminary stages of that, but it's moving forward, and monies have already been appropriated for that. So that's in its early stages of development. We're also talking to some other people who have resources that they intend to develop on in that area, and we're working closely with them in that. We're also, as I mentioned earlier, putting together a team that will be working with Mrs. Triggs on the redevelopment of that house. And in the interim period, we're doing an extensive analysis of the strengths, the weaknesses, the opportunities, and threats inside of the neighborhood and the community, so that when we get that funding, we will be in a position to move immediately to the visioning and the neighborhood planning phase of development. And the visioning and the neighborhood planning phase of development will be one of the essential ingredients in the neighborhood transformation process. So we'll pull together the residents so that they can come together over a period of time and develop a vision of the type of neighborhood they want to build. There is an old African proverb that says, a person without a target cannot miss, and neither can they hit anything. So the vision gives us the target. The vision says that we believe that this is the type of neighborhood that we want to create, anchored by these values and principles. Once we have that vision in place, we can then begin to create working groups that will come together and begin the process of systemically developing a plan that will be a kind of roadmap that can guide the community from where it is to where it wants to be. And a critical part of that plan is that we will attack all of the challenges facing the community at the same time, not just focusing on housing. Because no matter what you do with housing, housing alone is not a community. So we've got to deal with housing. We got to deal with education. We got to deal with health. We got to deal with employment. We got to deal with the social challenges that people are facing. And we have to do that at the same time across all sectors. So this will be a multi-sector approach to neighborhood development and transformation. And the reason for this is that we have learned that if you focus just on one sector,
right,
like I'm going to do education, okay, but the problems in housing, the problems in employment, the problems in recreation and youth development will cancel out what you're doing with education. So you have to attack them all at the same time. And that's not as complicated as it seems. If you have a coordinating body, we have people who are working in all of those areas and sectors. The problem is that if people in education pretend that housing doesn't exist, people in education have no relationships with the people in the social sciences and the others. While people in social services, they don't even speak to other people in social services. So if we bring all of these pieces together in a coordinated attack in a singular community, we can make that happen, and we will make that happen. And that's the kind of strategic approach. And so we're moving through these series of activities as we finalize the processes of funding. And a central part of what we're going to be doing, because of its reliance on existing groups and organizations, is capacity building, capacity building, capacity building, and more capacity building. So right now we're focusing on the nonprofit housing developers, strengthening that cohort, creating a kind of universal Habitat for Humanity framework, but that will be able to deal with a variety of different housing types and be able to produce new housing as well as rehabilitate older ones. But at every level, we will build capacity so that the people down on the ground in the neighborhoods and the communities will be empowered to bring about the change themselves. And one of the great challenges that we will face, and one that we intend to rise to, is training the existing neighborhood residents to become the workforce that drives the transformation and development of their communities. We understand that neighborhood transformation is an economy of scale. And the big issue is who will do the work. So when we talk, for example, about Kensington, everybody talks about, will there be a cap or won't there be a cap? That the creation of the cap will be some $3 billion, maybe even $4 billion. Well, at the Neighborhood Transformation Project, we raise a different question. Who will get the $4 billion? Who will get the $4 billion? Because the $4 billion is going to create jobs, opportunities, everything. And when we ask that question, white folks are going to get most of that money. The contractors, the workers, then they're going to import the minorities in, as they call them, to work on the project. Well, I love my brothers and sisters in New York. I love my brothers and sisters in Rochester. But what are dollars from my Kensington Expressway gonna help me in Rochester, New York City? We get the cap. White folks get the $4 billion. So we want to create a model where we get the cap and the $4 billion. Where we build the housing and we get the $40 to $80 million that it took to build the housing. We get the money that is used to develop our community and move away from the pattern now, like on Adams Street. The black people or whoever moves over there, they get the house and the debt. But somebody else walked away with all of the money it took to build that. And historically, that's what's happened. So we want the cake and we want to eat it too.
Fair enough. We're talking about the East Side Neighborhood Transformation Project. This project, developed by the Center for Urban Studies at the University of Buffalo, has selected a neighborhood in the city of Buffalo to look to transform it, as the title suggests, of course, Census Tract 166. This is Broadway to the south, Fillmore to the east, Best to the north, Genesee to the west, approximately. We'll give or take a couple of streets and blocks here and there. We're talking with the director of the Center for Urban Studies, Dr. Henry Louis Taylor Jr. We only have so much time left, but I want to get maybe just a little bit outside the transformation project, but yet keep it in this context. You've brought up the word joy and joyous so many times throughout this project that in essence, that really is the goal, the mission
yes.
of this transformation project. And we had a conversation before we went on the air, and I feel like I'm maybe breaking a trust of sorts here, but I have a feeling that you won't have any trouble opining on this, that we're in a time right now on a national scale and maybe even on a world scale that might not be in alignment with, like you said, a joyous vision for a neighborhood. Why is it important? Why now? Do you think it's important in context, in relation or contrast to what you see on the national level? Why is a project like this important?
I think a project like this is important because it's centered around what we call keeping the truth. The truth. And so it's about how do you build prosperous, healthy, and joyful communities. We're living in an age of the big lie. And in order for the big lie to triumph, the truth must be suppressed and pushed aside. That is the only way that the big lie can thrive and grow. And so we think that this notion that you can return to an era where blackness and people of color are rendered non-existent, where they're pushed to the margins, and that the gains and the freedoms that they fought for are now erased. We want to prove that that's not true. And so in order to rally the American people around different ways of imagining the future, we have to show them a way out of the crisis. We didn't get to Trump 2.0 because life was good. We got to Trump 2.0 because across this country, people are suffering. In neighborhoods and communities, people are afraid that joy has disappeared from the lives of folks, and they see nothing but dark clouds ahead. And so when you're fearful about tomorrow, when you're not sure if you're going to hold on to your jobs or your kids are going to be eat, you will believe the big lie. And when your leaders are too timid and cowardly to resist that, people become disillusioned. They lose faith and they lose hope in institutions. We want to ignite hope. We want to show right here in Buffalo that we can build healthy, prosperous, and joyful communities that are rooted around inclusion and belonging combined with systems change. Because equity, diversity, and inclusion without system change is like the sound of one hand clapping. It makes no noise. So only by bringing systems change to inclusion, diversity, and equity do we create the sweet music of social transformation and change. So this model that we're building is not an attempt to replicate the failed model of neighborhood development found in places like Clarence and Amherst and other places. And I say failed models of development because they are based upon exclusion and whiteness. We're building a community based on inclusion and belonging, a community that's not driven by raising real estate property values, but a community that is driven by community building and transformation with the aim of creating healthy and joyful people. We want to bring joy into the lives of people. And you only bring joy into the lives of people by creating housing that they can afford to live in, by creating neighborhoods and communities that are nurturing, by giving them the ability and the power and the authority to control the communities in which they live, work, play, and raise their families. We want truth to speak to the big lie. And our neighborhood development strategy will become the living manifestation of truth speaking to the great lie. For we are the truth keepers.
And also to extend on that, as much as we're focused on Census Tract 166 in the city of Buffalo, you believe that this not only will work, but can work and will work elsewhere, and we're not just talking about inner city communities.
Exactly. I really want to stress that we're building a new model of neighborhood development, a model of neighborhood development where we integrate people from across the racial framework as well as the class framework, and where neighborhood housing is no longer a commodity, but an asset. An asset not to produce more money, but an asset to produce joy and happiness that you can pass on from one generation to another generation to another generation. Life is about joy and happiness. It's about the social relationships that we build. And so we have to have resources for that. But we live in a world where getting that money is more important than anything else. So we put profits over people. Profits over the development of neighborhoods and communities. And we say that has to stop. We have to put people first. And if we put people first, we can build thriving, prosperous communities, but that also are healthy and full of joy. And so I say that because in the world that we have created, the underdeveloped, dilapidated neighborhood is necessary for the exclusive, predominantly white space. And so we want to end that. And that's why we're building a citywide movement to create a neighborhood. And as we perfect and develop that model, we intend to expand it to every other place and space. And eventually, I might not be there when it happens, but eventually, Clarence, we're coming. We're going to turn Clarence into an inclusive, diverse community where everybody belongs. We're going to build some social housing out there in Clarence. We're going to bring boatloads of poor people out there and create a new type of environment and prove that people from across the class and race and cultural divide can live in harmony and share residential space in an environment that is healthy, that is prosperous, and that is joyful. That's our goal. That's our intent. That's our aspiration, and that's our hope.
And I'm going to put this one on the tee for you a little bit here, Dr. Taylor, because when you introduced or announced the East Side Neighborhood Transformation Project and Census Tract 166. I believe you were asked by a member of the media, what's your plan B?
I think that's a great question. And the guy asked, and it was a beautiful, beautiful question. What is your plan B? My answer is that plan B is to make sure that plan A succeeds. Black and brown people have been living plan B for hundreds of years. Plan B don't work. So for us, plan B is to make sure that plan A works. It's as simple as that. In a way, it's back to a binary. And Patrick Henry said it all. Liberty or death. He didn't say liberty or what's plan B if we can't get liberty. No, it's liberty or death. And so it's plan A. And plan B is to rally the troops, pull people together. And in that vein, I want to stress that the Center for Urban Studies is only one member of a larger coalition of folks anchored by the African American Health Equity Task Force, the Buffalo Center for Health Equity, Back to Basic Ministries, King Urban Life Center, the Erie County Office of Health Equity, the UB Community Health Equity Institute.
And a lot of partners, of course, but we'll have to get to more of them. You come back with an update, sir, I appreciate your time today. Dr. Henry Louis Taylor, Jr., always a pleasure talking with us on What's Next. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.